The Library Channel is proud to present the fourth installment of the Simon Ortiz and La Briola Center Lecture on Indigenous Land, Culture, and Community. Sponsored by the ASU American Indian Studies Program, ASU Department of English, ASU American Indian Policy Institute, ASU La Briola Center, and the Heard Museum. Recorded on October 8, 2009 at the Heard Museum in Phoenix. Frank Goodyear opens the program.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening. I'm Frank Goodyear, the director of the Heard Museum, and it's a great pleasure to welcome you all here tonight. It's a very special evening for us. I was talking with our speaker before the lecture, and she mentioned that she'd never spoken here at the Heard Museum before, so it's past due time that we have an evening with Leslie Marmon Soko. This is a partnership that the Heard Museum has with Arizona State University, with the Simon Ortiz and La Briola Center lectures. And we're very pleased to be in partnership with ASU and very pleased to see so many ASU students here tonight. This is a wonderful facility for our communities, and we welcome you here tonight. I want to turn the microphone over to Simon Ortiz, our friend, with whom we've been working in the organization of these lectures. And I hope you enjoy your evening. I know I'm looking forward to listening to Leslie talk about her newest book, which we're getting a real advanced preview of because it's not coming out until the fall of 2010. Turquoise Ledge. So, Simon, thank you.
Kumasi, kaitawa haupa chutraya shapaka. Hello, how are you this evening? In the Acoma language, the greeting is always to ask how you are. And of course, the wish is always that all is well with you. Hello is really such a greeting itself. Oftentimes, we are not conscious of what our greetings are. But really, greetings are looking after each other, expressions of caring, expressions of sharing, and concern for one another. Because that is the reason that we are people. Our ancestors from many, many generations ago, grandmothers and grandfathers, that's what they provided for us in the manner of their living and as expression for how we should conduct our lives into the future, forward into the future. And of course, for our grandmothers and grandfathers of long time ago, they were looking ahead toward us who were their future, just like we were till tomorrow. Na chama taisi yoko kashait kaitran semer notimu skuwanzepo. Just like we look forward to tomorrow and tomorrow years ahead of us to be well for those people who will be living. That's what greetings really are. So I'm glad you're here. I'm glad that you're all well. I want to say just really a couple of things about Leslie Marmon Soko, our friend, our sister, who is from Kawaika, Laguna, Pueblo, which is in New Mexico. We are neighbors, sister pueblos. Aco or Acoma is just to the west And Kawaika is to the east of Ago. Sister pueblos are like, of course, relatives, but sisters in the sense of being part of the same family, being part of the cultural community, and be part of each other. And I have always regarded Leslie Marmon, Silco, to be such a sister, friend. We are of the same people, the same language even. Of course, today we speak mostly a lot of English, although we have, of course, the traditional Zeni, our language called Keras, which is a linguistic designation. Leslie grew up within the Laguna community, just like I grew up within the Ako'ome community. And I went to school in the schools that we were sent to within the Dzi-Yama community. Dzi-Yama is the McCarty's. McCarty's is an Irish word, of course, and Dzi-Yama is an Acoma word that means north door or north opening, which is where I grew up. And there was a small school, and I went to school there. And Leslie, in her own Kawaika community, where she was raised, there was their own schools. We are different people, but still the same. Writing is such a important institution that indigenous peoples participate in, because writing is really a community endeavor. It's not just a separate or individual or personal endeavor, but it's like any communication. It's like speaking, stories, telling about ourselves. And then, of course, writing what we tell about ourselves in the oral language into a written expression. We are still living the community. And that's what Leslie Marmon Silco's writing means to all of us. Her three books that I'll refer to are her first one, Ceremony. Ceremony was published in the late 1970s, and a lot of people have been affected by it from reading it and, of course, hearing about it. And then her other novel that is, I think, regarded very highly as an expression of community is Gardens in the Dunes, which is set more or less in Arizona, western part of Arizona, on the Colorado River, and tells about not a distant past, because nothing is really distant, especially in the indigenous way. Yesterday's happenings are part of today, just like tomorrow's happenings are part of taking place now and even into the past. The other novel that she is most noted for is Almanac of the Dead. Almanac of the Dead, sometimes my students feel a little bit intimidated by, because it's almost 800 pages long. A long, long story. Actually, that is how we know ourselves, because we as Native people, as Indian people, if you prefer that term, or indigenous people of the Americas, have a long, long story. And that long story is really what is at the core of what this land is, the core that is America. Nuyu emi taisi sa ta atishi. Noyo emi tsaya taistis to te es taistis to ta atishahano. Because we are the original cultural communities in this land called the Americas. And this is the significance of the long story and stories that Leslie Marmon Silko shares with us through her work as a writer, as a novelist, as a poet, as a storyteller, as a person of her community. And then, of course, we must always regard each other as persons of our community. So please, with those few words, welcome Leslie Marmon Silko.
It's really wonderful to be here tonight, and I just want to remind you what a wonderful, wonderful teacher and poet and human being you have here with you, with Simon, and you're really lucky to have him. You don't know how lucky you are. I would not be the writer I am without the influence that Simon's poetry and, moreover, just his spirit and way. I fall far short of being the kind of person that Simon is, but at least with him, I always have a wonderful goal to aim for, and that is just with his regard for human beings and how he conducts himself. Tonight, what I would like to do is to read a little bit from the new work. I already had lost page one. I managed to find it. Working with a manuscript reminds us of why bound books are so important. You have all these pages going this way and that way. I suppose the easy thing to do would to be not to read something from the manuscript in progress, but I always feel like I want to bring to my readers and even to people that don't know my work to bring the new work, even though it's rough and some of the pages will be lost, and so I don't want to stand up here and apologize too much, but this is the Turquoise Ledge is I decided that I'm 61 now and I keep forgetting more and more things. I thought, well, you know, if I was ever going to do a sort of memoir or to write about my childhood, now would be the time. Even though I'm not very comfortable with nonfiction, not really. I became a fiction writer for a reason. But I set about to do it because because I wanted to, and then I started to question why in the world did I want to do this. So what I would like to do this evening is I'll sort of skip around and read different sections to give you a sense of it. I focused around walks that I started to take in the Tucson Mountains, where I've lived for about 31 years. I used to ride horseback years ago, and then I got to thinking I ought to start walking and not make the horse carry me. And so it's wonderful what you can see on foot. Up on horseback, you can see a great deal, but it's very different. And so the Turquoise Ledge is sort of organized around that, but I also go back to my childhood, and so then what I would like to do is open this up. This is supposed to be a sort of relaxed, this is not a formal lecture by any means, but what I love to do is I love to hear, I love to have a dialogue with the audience, and you know, want to encourage people to ask questions. So I better just get going so we don't run out of time. That's the other thing I'm famous for, is running over time. So here's the first page that was lost. It starts with my preface. I was born in 1948, the year of the supernova in the mixed spiral galaxy. My friend, Joy Harjo, poet and astrologer, charted a triple triune for the afternoon of March 5th, 1948 in Albuquerque. But dark planets rule my first house. The first house is the one about marriages and stuff. 1948 is the year of the rat. We rats, and I copied this off of a placemat in a Chinese restaurant. This is what it really says. We rats seldom make lasting friendships. We let the correspondence lapse and don't return phone calls. A great deal of what I call memories are bits and pieces I recall vividly. But the process we call memory, even recent memory, involves imagination. We learn to ignore discrepancies between our memory of an event and a sister's memory. We can't be certain of anything. Fortunately, my subconscious remembers everything I need. Whatever I can't recall later comes back to me as I write fiction. I make myself a fictional character so I can write about myself. It wasn't easy to write about close family members or friends. I worried about accuracy and their privacy. Also, these relationships are dynamic and shifting, even with those who've passed on. I'd already written about them. In some instances, I'd already written about them, or I didn't feel this was the time. In other instances, I recalled what my mother used to say: if you can't say something good about someone, don't say anything. Still, I wanted to give a glimpse of the places and times I've known. I wanted to add a few pieces to the mosaic of stories we call history. Finally, I wanted to give some notion of what commands my attention and how I while away my time. When I signed the two-book contract with Penguin, Publishers Weekly ran this little item that said, "And Silco hasn't published a book in 8 years," or something like that. And I thought, wow, you know. So this is to give you an idea, this is what I've been up to. My friend Bill Orison taught me to speed walk on flat ground in town, but I prefer the hills to the city, so I adapted the speed walk to the steep, rough terrain. The walks took me back into the Tucson Mountains, to the old trails where I rode my horses 30 years ago when I first moved here. The trails are narrow footpaths made by the ancient tribal people who lived in the Tucson Mountains for thousands of years. Later on, prospectors used the old trails and added new trails to their mining claims. The trail I took on my walks past the old diggings, they were never actual mines. One is a 20-foot vertical shaft where two big white barn owls live and once emerged as I rode by on horseback, truly startling and astonishing. On foot, I can see the ant palaces, some in solid rock, others with starburst circles of stones they've mined and somehow moved up from below. The star pattern reminded me of the star being images incised into sandstone thousands of years ago. Eventually, the trail descends and crosses the big arroyo and continues, but here I turn and follow the big arroyo home. The sandy bottom of the arroyo is crisscrossed with bird and animal tracks that make the trail that humans and animals have used for thousands of years. In rough, steep terrain, arroyos may provide the only access to an area, so the arroyos are public right-of-ways for wildlife and humans on foot or horseback. Motor vehicles are barred. At first, I didn't pay much attention to the stones in the arroyo because I was focused on my walking. I was new to the notion of the speed walk through the desert. In the arroyo, the deep drifts of fine white sand had a gravity of their own that sucked my feet down. So in those early months of learning how to walk over rough desert terrain at a fast pace, I had all I could do to keep moving. I wasn't thinking about rocks in the arroyo. I learned not to lift my feet in and out of the deep sand, but instead to slide my feet through the top layer of sand very rapidly, to shuffle my feet back and forth so they didn't have a chance to sink further into the deep sand. Slowly, it got easier, and I started to notice the pebbles and rocks in the fine white sand and the animal tracks and signs of coyote and bobcat in the arroyo. I began to find small rocks and pebbles streaked with turquoise. Over the years, I'd picked up some of these turquoise rocks, but I wasn't as interested in the stones as I am now. I needed almost contact with the turquoise rocks on my walks to develop my interest. Turquoise doesn't originate deep in the earth, as many precious minerals and gems do. It forms when certain chemical reactions take place during the weathering of surface minerals. Water is a necessary component of the formation of turquoise. No wonder indigenous people of the deserts connected turquoise with water and rain. It wasn't just the color of blue or green. Turquoise meant water had been there. The surface minerals necessary for the formation of turquoise are copper, aluminum, and phosphates. Turquoise is a hydrate of copper. Hydrate of copper indicates water in the latticework of the turquoise molecule. Iron can substitute for aluminum and results in a color variation toward green. In my research, I learned the turquoise stones I'd found were technically not turquoise, but chrysocolla, which is a minor copper ore, a hydrated copper silicate restricted to a shallow depth of less than 20 meters. Volcanic disturbance is required to make the cracks and fissures that allow water to reach the aluminum and iron ores and feldspars. Turquoise, malachite, and chrysocolla are often found with one another, so they were all called turquoise in the old days. Some turquoise was harder and shinier, while some was chalky and soft. Chalky turquoise was the term for chrysocolla. It is not as easy as one might think to tell the difference between the two without chemical analysis in a laboratory. And of course, you have to smash the stones up to find out. I prefer the lovely sound of the word turquoise and even malachite to the sound of chrysocolla. Chrysocolla sounds like the name of a soft drink, chrysicola. Turquoise comes from the 16th century French word for Turkish, turquoise, so I will use the word turquoise. After a walk, I would make a few notes about what I'd seen and where. The next time I walked, I wouldn't be able to locate any of the places I'd noted on the earlier walk. The ant palaces I'd seen the previous day would have vanished. If gravity is distributed in this universe unevenly, as they suspect, then there are places here on Earth where the gravity is weaker or stronger, where things may speed up or slow down. Differing gravitational pulls means that when you fall off a horse or a roof, alternate dimensions open up, which slow the motion down, and the sensation is not of a fall, but a floating, although to an outside observer on a parallel plane, your fall appears to happen very fast. At a certain walking speed, my eyes received light images from a parallel plane. Parallel planes or worlds may be visible briefly at certain points in this world from time to time. Thus, the discrepancies between my recollections and notes immediately after a walk and what I actually found when I attempted to locate these places later. The idea was that the exercise in open air would release my mind into a less self-conscious state where I could better perceive the delicacy of the light and the dawn moisture in the breeze. How sweet the earth smells and how luxurious it feels to move through this yellow dawn light. The idea of the fast pace was a cardiovascular workout, but also the pace of the walks helped me edit the experience of the walks to the essentials. As I walked along, I began to imagine a great ledge of turquoise temporarily buried under the sand and rocks. To find so many pieces of turquoise and the millions of tons of arroyo sand and pebbles and rocks meant the turquoise ledge must be large. Or is there more than one ledge of turquoise? So we start out and the walks and the stones that I find and what I see are a part of it. But then, of course, I begin to I also begin to reminisce, and I have a whole section on the ancestors. Let me just see if I can. I don't limit myself to turquoise rocks. I keep a watch out for any sort of colorful or odd pebble or stone, and for bits of driftwood in the big arroyo. The Tucson Mountains were part of a volcanic ridge that exploded millions of years ago. Great fiery clouds welded ash and breccias of basalt, quartzite, and limestone that formed from the vast oceans that came and went from time to time. The great heat melted the quartz into chalcedony, jasper, and malachite that sometimes bear hairline fractures from the shock of the volcanic explosions. The footpaths through the Tucson Mountains are ancient. Humans have lived in these hills and arroyos for thousands of years. The Palo Verde and mesquite trees have great quantities of beans in June, and the saguaro fruit and prickly pear ripened at the same time. The small game and birds were easy to hunt. For the ancient people, these hills and arroyos held everything they might need for survival. Okay, now I want to read a little bit to you. So, okay, I'm going to skip around. And I want to read to you about the rattlesnakes. When I first got down to Tucson, the most friendly beings for a long time that I knew were the snakes. Tucson isn't a very easy place to be. Actually, it's rather as an outsider or newcomer. I still regret the summer after my divorce from John Silko in 1979 because I allowed the neighbor boys to kill the big red dust-colored rattler on the west side of the house. I tried to persuade the big rattlesnake to relocate by splashing buckets of cold water on him three times. My younger son, Kaz, was 7 at the time, and I was afraid he'd get bitten. But after that day, I promised myself to protect the rattlesnakes. Yet my ignorance and carelessness have killed a number of rattlesnakes. Ordinary chicken wire I discarded became the death snare for a fine 3-foot-long rattler on the west slope of the hill behind my house. The snake was able to get its head and neck through the oval opening, but when the fatter part of it could not fit and the snake attempted to back out, the wire snagged its scales, so it was trapped and died terribly. I was able to save a big, beautiful Sonoran gopher snake that became trapped while climbing the chicken wire enclosure around the back patio. I got rid of all the chicken wire. Hardware cloth with its tiny mesh is superior in every way to chicken wire and does far less damage to reptiles. Monofilament nylon netting is used to protect trees from birds. Used to protect trees, I guess it's fruit trees, from birds, is even worse than chicken wire for reptiles. The threads of monofilament nylon easily entangle a lizard's toes and feet, and as it struggles to get free, its delicate scales only become more entangled. The iridescent sky blue lizards that live on the roof and walls of my house are usually combative if they fall into human hands. But the fat sky blue lizard I found tangled in the nylon netting remained calm as I snipped away the netting with my kitchen shears. Somehow the lizard understood I meant no harm. Similarly, I've heard cowboys describe mule deer entangled in barbed wire. Mule deer that were entangled in barbed wire, and the mule deer allowed the cowboys to cut them free of the wire without a struggle. After I freed the sky lizard, I removed that wretched nylon bird netting from the patio and was about to drop it into the trash when I noticed horse damage on a young mesquite tree in my front yard. So I carelessly tossed the netting over the tree and forgot about it. A few months passed. Then early one morning, just at dawn, I heard my dogs barking like maniacs. And when I went outside, I found a big rattlesnake caught in that piece of bird netting. The snake was terribly snagged with the nylon filaments cutting deeply into his body at the thickest point, about 10 inches from his head, which moved freely while his middle remained trapped. He was about 30 inches long and as big around as my wrist. But as soon as I called off the dogs, the snake stopped rattling. It was early July. The sun was rising, and in only a few hours the trapped snake would die from the heat. I had to save his life, but I didn't know how I was going to do it because I was alone and the nearest neighbor a half mile away. I didn't have much time. The sun was up and felt warmer by the minute. The snake didn't want dogs near him, but he didn't seem to mind me, not even when I squatted down and slowly and very carefully examined how badly he was trapped. It was bad. As the snake struggled to free itself, it had only pulled the netting tighter until the filaments drew blood on the tender skin between the scales. I had to act fast. I ran indoors and found a pair of tin shears, about 12 inches long, handles and blades included. No matter how I did it, I was going to have to put both hands within easy striking range of the head and upper body that was not entangled and moved freely. The big snake was calm so far, but I'd have to press the tips of the steel blades firmly against the snake's body in order to reach the nylon filaments jammed under the scales. What would the snake do then? The sun was higher and I had no choice. I found a dry aloe stalk about 20 inches long with a forked end. Dry aloe stalks are hollow and flimsy, and I knew the big snake could easily break the stalk, but force wasn't the point. The aloe stalk was there to give me the illusion of safety. Twice I gently tried to put the stalk's fork over the snake's neck to give me the illusion of control, but he became uneasy when the stalk actually touched him. So I withdrew it a few inches, but held it between me and the snake. I hoped the snake could read my thoughts because I was determined to set him free before the sun killed him. With my left hand, I held the aloe stalk like a wand above his neck without touching him. Somehow this made me feel safer, though the stalk would have been completely useless if the snake suddenly doubled back to strike. I watched the snake intently for his reaction as I slowly moved my right hand with the tin shears toward his belly scales entangled in the nylon filaments. He didn't seem to mind my proximity, so I took a deep breath and focused entirely on the nylon threads cutting under the snake's scales. I didn't want to cut or harm the snake in any way. I slowly moved the tin shears down to the ensnared scales. I was so intently focused on freeing the snake from the netting, the snake must have somehow understood, because the snake allowed me to press the cold steel of the shears against his body. That touch was provocation enough that he might have reached back and struck me, but instead the snake remained calm, stretched out and motionless. Then a strange confidence came over me, which I still can't explain. In my left hand, I pushed the steel tips firmly against the snake's body to reach the threads. I managed to get a nylon thread in the shears and snip, and the snake didn't react. I exhaled, then I gently but firmly put the blades of the shears under another nylon thread and cut it. When he felt his fat midsection cut free, the big diamond back glided away gracefully, and I felt blessed. I didn't see the big snake again until late October. It was dark in my front yard. I was coming from the car on the driveway without a flashlight. Near the mesquite tree, I felt my foot leave the ground with a sickening sensation of live, moving flesh under my foot, and instantly I knew what I'd done. As I jumped as high as I ever have, away from the snake, I heard him rattle once softly, and then he was gone. My carelessness should have earned me a snake bite on the instep or ankle. Maybe the big rattlesnake remembered that I once set him free. Maybe the snake knew I meant him no harm. So that's one of my little snake things. And then I want to leave time for questions. So now I'm going to skip over. I'm going to skip over to the grasshoppers. And this was a piece, I had made the notes and I had made little sketches and drawings. And then Simon asked me for a contribution for his guest editorship, the indigenous people issue of the Kenyon Review. And so I wanted to give him something very special. So I sort of stole something out. I wrote this for him, and though I knew that it's supposed to be part of the turquoise ledge. So now I want to read. Every summer, my great grandma Amu grew cosmos, 4 o'clocks, morning glories, and hollyhocks. I plant pots of cosmos in the autumn now and think often of Amu. In her yard there were lilacs and the old-fashioned rugosa rose bushes and the cascading white shrub bridal bouquet next to the swing on the L-shaped porch that faced the northeast. A huge datura plant grew in the sandy floodplain soil in her backyard. She called it a moonflower because the blossoms opened at night. My garden is 15 or 20 mismatched clay and plastic flower pots on the porch of my studio under the big mesquite in the front yard. I drag this potted garden back and forth from the sun to the shade in the summer. In November, I sow seeds before the cold weather comes. The seedlings like the milder temperatures and they grow quickly after the equinox. By the end of January, my front porch is perfumed by pots of datura, alyssum, cosmos, and snapdragons. On the nights the temperatures fall below freezing, I make tents out of old towels and sheets to protect the cosmos and datura. I drag the pots back into the sun all winter, then back undercover at night over and over. This is the fate of any gardener of alien plants from outside the desert. There is no point in preparing a flower bed. The desert trees and shrubs send out roots overnight to suck the water from a flower bed or tree well. The mesquite tree in my front yard will even steal the water from my clay and plastic pots if I don't block the drainage holes in the bottom of the pots with pieces of slate. The pots are discolored with streaks of gypsum from the well water, and some of them are cracked. The garden shade, the green leaves, the seeds, and the water buckets attract birds and rodents, which attract rattlesnakes. The cool of the dampness and the deep shade of the pots give great comfort to the rattlesnakes that live around and under my house. Snakes will perish in direct sun and the summer midday heat in a matter of minutes, much as we humans will die of heat. Along with their heat detector sensors, the rattlesnakes have organs to detect the coolest spot in the area. One morning, I walked back and forth on the porch with the hose watering the flower pots, past the geranium that overhangs its pot and sweeps the porch bricks. After an hour or so, I took a break and sat down where I could see a small brown rattler coiled up under the overhanging geranium on the porch. My feet had been only inches from him all that time, but the snake recognized me. He does this often. He must do this often, but I never noticed him until today. He seems unconcerned about me. I'm not enough of a threat to make the snake want to leave the sweet, cool shade of the clay pots where ground squirrels and sparrows stray from time to time. Okay, I'm gonna just skip over to the, so you get some idea of my poor, well, let's see. I grow pots of datura because datura withstands the heat and ultraviolet radiation of the sun. The daturas are interesting to grow because they are a vital part of the life cycle of the beautiful hawk moths that may grow as large as hummingbirds. The hawk moths visit the datura flowers on moonlit nights, guided by the perfume and the luminous white flowers the size of saucers. The hawk moths lay their eggs in the dirt around the base of the datura plant, and the larvae grow into huge, beautiful, bright leaf green caterpillars with white markings. And of course, the caterpillars eat the datura leaves, but they don't kill the datura. At the end of September, the heat began to recede, and after a rainstorm revived my garden. The pink and the white rain lilies bloomed, and I kept watering them after the rain left, for the bees and the butterflies and for me. One morning as I watered, I saw two large grasshoppers, amazing in their beauty and size. Their outer wings were emerald green in the center, with peacock green along the edges. The inner wings were hues of magenta red and magenta pink, with lacy leaf patterns in bright yellow. Their faces and necks were outlined in bright yellow on jade green. Their antennae were bright orange with black, bold black stripes. They sat in the cluster of pink rain lily blossoms they'd been eating. They regarded me fearlessly with great majesty. Their bright black eyes looked intently into mine. As soon as I saw them, I wanted to sketch the grasshoppers in colored pencil, but I was busy and went off to do other chores. I worked on the manuscript. I forgot about the grasshoppers. The next day, I found one of the grasshoppers under the potted fig tree. He walked unsteadily, as if drunk or sick. His antennae moved feebly, but he didn't seem afraid of me. I picked him up carefully and moved him so he didn't drown when I watered the fig tree. I wondered what happened. Poison? Then I remembered. His life was the length of summer. He was dying of old age. Still, he was arresting in his beauty, and his steady gaze connected with mine. The vivid colors and intricate markings were unlike any I'd ever seen. I left him in the rain lilies to die in peace. The next morning, I found the grasshopper in the rain lily leaves. Dead, some might say, because he didn't move. But he was still brightly colored, so there was life in him yet. I gently picked him up and brought him into my studio. I needed to hold him in place somehow. All I had was a shot glass where I stood him up so I could see his thorax plainly. As I sketched him, I realized he wanted a portrait in the manner of the star being portraits I'd painted. In the year 2006, I wanted to concentrate on I'd always wanted to be a visual artist. I didn't really want to be a writer, so I finally took that time, and I did these. I found out that I was supposed to do these star being portraits. So I cover that anyway. I realized he wanted a portrait in the manner of the star being portraits I'd painted. Later, after I finished the grasshopper sketch, I brought out a big canvas like the ones I used for the star being portraits, and I prepared the canvas with stucco and left it to dry, because I like to feel like I'm painting on a wall, not on canvas, so I used this stuff. I was thinking about how to present the grasshopper face on in the manner of the star beings. It seemed difficult because of the shape of the grasshopper's head, so I didn't work on the portrait. A few days later, while I was outside to watch the rain clouds gather from a hurricane in Mexico, I noticed another of the big colorful grasshoppers under the mesquite tree by the front porch. It looked me in the eyes, and I knew at once this grasshopper was a messenger from Lord Chapulín. And of course, Chapulín it may not be pronounced that way. My Nahuatl pronunciation, you can just forget about it. But that's the Nahuatl term for grasshopper. And in New Mexico, that was also the term used for grasshopper, Chapulín. I knew at once this grasshopper was a messenger from Lord Chapulin. Get back to work. I thought a profile was a tempting variation from the portraits I'd done, so I got out my sketchbook and colored pencils to attempt a sketch in profile, but I just couldn't get it right. Chapulin didn't want a portrait in profile. He wanted his portrait face on, like the portraits of the star beings. I had to work a while to get the face on pose to look right. At first, I drew the eyes on the sides of the grasshopper's head, but this was incorrect. The eyes were more to the front of the face. As I sketched, I understood Chapulin wanted to be seen and remembered as he was on the big fiesta day in August, when there was so many good things to eat, and he celebrated by wearing powdered turquoise all over his head and face, out of regard for Tlaloc, Lord of the Rain, whose color is turquoise. I relied on my colored pencil sketch to draw the outline of Chapulin's portrait on the canvas. In the sketch, his buckskin leggings and moccasins could be seen, but on the canvas, only his head and chest and waist fit. I was pleased with the work I'd done, so I left the portrait for the rest of the week while I worked on the manuscript. Another week or two passed. Then I noticed one of the big grasshoppers on a datura plant outside my studio window. The grasshopper gazed in at Lord Chapulin's portrait on the easel. I felt uneasy because I'd done no work on the portrait for a long time. Then one morning outside my studio under the mesquite tree, Lord Chapulin himself approached me. He came straight toward me and climbed up from the ground to a sandstone bench to get closer to me. He regarded me gravely and remained motionless on the sandstone while I looked at the hues of green, the magenta pinks and reds, the black and orange markings, so I'd get them right when I painted him. Then he lost interest in me and turned his attention to the rain lilies that stirred in the breeze. A day or two later, as I watered, I splashed a pot of purple alyssum, and suddenly there was Lord Chapulin, indignant and glaring at me. Forget about your writing. Complete my portrait. That night, when I went to plug in the lights under my car to ward off pack rats, in the beam of the flashlight, I saw a team of brown ants struggle to carry a dead grasshopper that resembled the others, but this one was much smaller, with lighter yellow-green hues on the outer wings and light pink on the inner wings. The grasshoppers wouldn't last much longer. The next morning, I hurried back to the portrait before I forgot the pink hue, and I repainted the dark magenta on the portrait's inner wings with a light magenta pink. The effect was a rosy magenta, perfect, exactly what Chapulin desired. I knew what Chapulin desired because he communicated with certain thoughts that would cross my mind, thoughts about what he wanted for his portrait, thoughts he sent directly to me. At one point, I whited out a lot of dark green color I didn't like, and Chapulin's portrait looked ghostly, and I called it Ghost Grasshopper, but I couldn't leave it that way. Chapulin wanted to be portrayed as he was in life, not death. Still, the grasshopper figure all in white on the red background looked really cool. Lord Chapulin is secretive and mysterious. Those of his kind may appear only once in 84 years, while others return in cycles of 7 or 21 years. When the portrait was finally completed in the last week of October, I opened the front door one morning, and there was Chapulin warming himself in the sunlight on the top branches of the greasewood bush that faced the studio window where his portrait sat. I watched him for a while to figure out whether he liked the portrait, but I couldn't be sure. So I turned back to paint the white flowers on his belt. As I touched up the green on the wings, I felt such happiness and pleasure. Later when I looked out, he was gone. I watched for Chapulin and the others whenever I watered. I even looked for dead grasshoppers, but they were all gone without a trace. Carried off by ants, scattered by the wind. So that's my probably not a very good sampling from the manuscript, but I wanted to read the Chapulín section. And of course, the paintings of that I did of Chapulín, actually I did two of them, and some of the sketches, and the sketches are very sketchy, because of course, I'm not really a trained visual artist, but anyway, they go together, and so that was the piece that I gave to Simon. So now I haven't really left us. I hope we can have more time than I see here. But anyway, so I would like now to be quiet so somebody else can say something.